And if you actually manage people well, if you care, actually care about them, actually put them first, actually care about yourself and your family and take care of people, most of the rest of the stuff will work itself out because people will develop trust in each other and then they will trust you. And so I think cultivating trust through relationships is actually critical to being a good leader.
Hello, my name is Emily Jansen, and this is the Leadership is Female podcast. We interview women in the sports and entertainment businesses to teach you the tips and the mindset that will get you to the top faster. Marian Wright Edelman said, "You can't be what you can't see." Let's bring visibility to women who are crushing it in their roles. Join us week after week, season after season, as we reach back to extend a hand to pull you forward. We will lead you forward because leadership is female. Welcome to the Leadership is Female podcast. Jess Carter, a fellow Midwesterner, first of all. So we are hitting record a little late because, of course, we had to find all of the commonalities that we could about where we are from. But you are on the show today because you are a VP of Client Experience and Delivery Ops at Resultant, a modern consulting firm focused on data analytics, which we love, tech, digital transformation, and you've helped strategically grow and develop government services teams. And you have so much to offer to us today. So welcome to the show. Tell us who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is already so fun. How I got here, it was through 1,000 little decisions that led me to this place. And I would say, you know, I went to college to major in religions. And what I didn't realize at the time, and looking back, it makes sense, is I was really studying people. I really was fascinated about folk religions and how people actually practice those things, and got to study in context. So I went to about 26 different countries, and sort of over this time realized I was just really, I'm just fascinated by people. I think humans are so interesting. When I got out of college, I had, I don't know, like $80,000 in student loan debt. So I realized I needed a job, like a real one. And I went looking, and so kind of landed in some nonprofit work. And what I knew went from a young age was I had a leader as a dad. And, you know, I just kind of learned if I could follow the best leader I can find at any time, it was worth the job jump. Just take the job with the best leader I can find. So I had a great leader with me that kind of became a coach or a mentor on the job at one nonprofit. And then she left and I took a different job, and that wasn't really great. It didn't work out where there weren't, I would say, like highest and best leaders around me. And so she offered to pull me back to her new company, and I followed her. And then there was an opportunity for me to learn Six Sigma Black Belt. And so I did that and kind of became into, I learned what process improvement was, which was great for me because I'm a 3 on the Enneagram and I love improvement. As long as I'm the one doing it, not the one receiving improvement feedback.
Okay. I know. Cause I'm also a 3, which is why we're already such great friends.
Right. Yeah. I was like, and I've worked on that too. I can receive feedback now. Congratulations, Jess. But basically I did process improvement. That just notoriously leads to systems. To improve processes today, you're improving systems. So I ended up basically designing like the back end and front end of a system and didn't really even realize it. I didn't know that's what I was doing. And eventually some friends sort of helped me realize I'm doing technology things and application things, and maybe I should do them in the public sector. So I jumped again and followed some great leaders at what was formerly Katzapper Miller Consulting, which is now Resultant, where I've worked for nearly the last 10 years. And so I had no public sector experience. I had no idea what I was doing. It was totally drinking from the fire hose. In fact, their major unemployment system had just gone live 4 months ago. They were on a mainframe before that. It was chaos. And so it was like, I mean, it was like defect hell. Like there were thousands and thousands of defects, and we were trying to triage them and understand. And so I just sort of jumped into a mess and helped clean it up. It was what I've done before, just in a different context. And that has elaborated into a decade of the most interesting technology and data projects I couldn't have imagined I'd be part of. by just kind of being faithful with what I was given. And so by running, you know, a core component of unemployment, I got the opportunity to run my first independent project on the workforce side of those agencies. Or by doing that, I was asked to go do that for another state in Reno, Nevada. And so I had the pleasure of doing that for a while and being a traveling consultant. And then I jumped to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, Office of Early Childhood Out of School Learning to help children get vouchers and audit daycares. COVID hit, and I was helping with the COVID response in Indiana with the governor's office. And it just became this really phenomenal career because I follow great leaders and make sure I'm contributing as much as I can to be, you know, part of the teams around me. So that's sort of kind of a little bit about me.
Well, I can't wait to jump into process improvements and systems. But before we go there, you said 26 countries.
I did.
That you traveled to. So I'm sure all of our listeners are asking the same question and saying, Emily, ask her about all of her travels. So tell us a little bit more about that. Where did you go? What was the most interesting place you traveled to? And you said your driving force was your curiosity about people. Yeah. But tell us about that travel period of your life then, and then how you keep up with that interest today as a busy career woman.
Yeah. So the beginning will sound more interesting than the end because I'm a busy career woman with two small children. And so we're doing some travel, but not as much. But we'll get back to it. So yeah, I mean, I started out traveling, doing like volunteer work. And so in South America, and then I worked with children with special needs in Ukraine and orphans in Ukraine in two different instances. Also Iraqi refugees in Jordan and Amman. I was with a program called Seeds of Peace that is a phenomenal program that takes children from conflict areas and puts them together in a camp for 2 weeks. So you kind of learn just to share a room and play soccer and build relationships. And they have professional facilitators at night that help you really deal with things. So I'm 35. So my conflict area cohort was the Middle East. It, you know, 9/11 had happened right before I went to high school. And they wanted to make sure we get along. So to this day, I have friends that are in, you know, seven different countries in the Middle East that I message and make sure they're okay. And we check in with each other and keep up because we went to camp together. I mean, it's just such a brilliant program. I also did, when I worked with the orphans and then the special needs children in Ukraine, Mission to Ukraine is an organization that I went with that I really believe is doing today really important work there. And then I cheated. So Emily, I did semester at sea. So I just like bing, 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 10 different countries in one semester. And it was amazing. I almost didn't go because I was worried about the cost of it. And I kind of told my parents and they were like, you're going to have to take out a loan. Like, we can't do it. And I decided it wasn't financially responsible. And then I remember being right where I was on I-65 on the way home from Chicago to my school. And my dad called me and he was like, someday you might have kids and wish you could travel and maybe it'll be harder. Like, maybe if you want to go, go. And the 35-year-old that has kids is so glad that he encouraged me to go, because that was an absolute, just going back to study. You know, I was in a Buddhist monastery in Japan and in a Hindu temple in India and stayed in visited a cult church in Southeast Asia and, temples in Malaysia. And so I just had such a rich experience learning about world history from the world. And actually I was in the South China Sea when Obama was elected. And so there's just these really interesting moments in my life that are sort of, interesting because they connect history to my life. And I've just really enjoyed how that's made, you know, human history come alive.
So this might be a hard question to answer, but for those who like can't rationalize or squeeze in travel, whether it's when you're young or today,
yeah,
like, what impact do you think that had on your life? Obviously you don't know any different because you are who you are today, but you know, for me, I loved my college experience and I wanted every minute I could on campus, but looking back today, I'm like, oh, I should have pushed myself further outside my comfort zone and studied abroad. And, I did let finances get in the way because I didn't want to take out a loan to do it. So just, I don't know, kind of reflect on that a little bit. Like, what do you think all that travel, what impact did it have on you today?
Yeah. I mean, I think it had a fundamental impact on me. I mean, there's no way I'm not shaped by those events. I mean, one, the realization of how very not different I am. I was just born somewhere else from anyone else. Whether it's economic status, whether it's education. I mean, I just was born where I was and have some of the privileges I have. And I think that it's really important that I'm conscious of those when it comes to how I contribute in the world. And so I just think it normalizes all humans. I think if you're not around, it's kind of like diversity. If you're around a very homogeneous group of people, it's really uncomfortable to meet someone new. It's really uncomfortable. And it shouldn't be, but it just is because you're not used to it. Mm-hmm. So in this weird way, I think it helped desensitize me to a whole bunch of things. And that doesn't mean I don't get, you know, desensitized sometimes still. I've spent most of the last decade in the Midwest in America. You know, some of my homogeneousness is coming back to me, but it does also teach me a couple things that are funny. One, I had no idea that it was basically a forced undergraduate in how to know if you're safe. If you're traveling all the time, you kind of just get this gut sense of like, I'm not where I should be right now. Like there's too many eyes on me. Something's going on. Let's get out of here. And that can happen in, you know, Indiana as easily as it can happen in India. And so it just depends on where you are. But I sort of had this weird innate sense suddenly from all that travel of, you know, I'm in a place where it's sort of, you know, normal and it's fine and I can talk to people, or there's just some uncomfortable attention and maybe we find our way to a different place. So that was a weird outcome. But I think also that also meant that I knew when I belonged, or I knew when that wasn't the case. And I could sit at a local bar and get to know some people from a community for a few days, like just come visit and say hi, or volunteer at a charity in India. And so I think for me, it forced this connection where I felt like my DNA was truly no different than theirs. And not to over romanticize it, but I really do think that helped me when it comes to, I'm a consultant. I solve complex problems for humans. I don't solve them differently, I pray, than depending on who you are or what elements of your life look like. Like the concept is that there is equity, at least an intention toward equity, and there's less unconscious bias, I would hope, because of some of that travel.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a beautiful answer. And I think that there's a bridge to this next question as well. As you said, you solve the problem for the problem, not for like a specific person. And you have spoken about how leadership is temporal and why understanding your role is temporary is important to ensuring your team's growth. So talk a little bit about that. As people who, a lot of us have larger than life egos that are attached to our titles and our positions. So how do you work through this construct?
Yeah. So I think it's about keeping yourself in check. I think there's a sense of, you know, as I'm going through a problem I'm trying to solve, some of the things I'm thinking around the problem are, often, is it worth solving? And if so, why? And if I can't answer that question, that's a problem. If it is worth solving, is it important or is it urgent? It can be both, but usually something's either urgent or important. Usually if it's urgent, it is truly, to your point, temporal. It needs solved by a certain time or date or else something. And so that leads me to my next comment, which is what's the cost of doing nothing? What's the cost of doing the wrong thing? And so to me, those things help me orient myself. It's almost like if I have a new problem in a new industry that I've never solved before, Emily, it's almost like honestly, if you were to imagine what it's like to be in my brain, it is almost like you have vertigo immediately. And everything I'm doing, all the questions I'm asking is to try to like sit down and end the cycles of madness. And I don't know where north is. Like, I'm just trying to orient myself to the problem at hand. And that can feel really uncomfortable and slightly unempathetic, because there are times where I'm just not getting it. And I'll have to say, I don't understand the consequences. Like, you look terrified and afraid and you're sweating. And I don't understand the risk here. Help me under. And sometimes that does mean that the reality is there isn't as much risk as that person thinks there is. And we help each other see that, but I'm not coming at them assumptively or on a high horse telling them that. We're discovering it together. And there's a huge difference. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm thinking about this in what you said earlier about your work in improvement of systems, processes yeah. and systems. And I am imagining being in your brain and looking at this problem sort of topsy-turvy, like almost in like, I don't know, that 3D environment where like everything is kind of like swirling around your head. And then how do you pull all this information, apply the questions of what is the cost of doing nothing? And what is the cost of doing the wrong thing? And like, where do we start? And how do you take this information and align it in a way to create a system? So walk us through the next step, right? Like when you're starting to get the picture,
yeah.
What does that system or process development look like? And maybe if you have an example of one that, you know, if we're not Six Sigma black belts, like, can we understand what that looks like?
Yeah. And just to be clear too, so while I am a Six Sigma black belt, and I think it was really important for a young career, especially with an undergraduate in religions, it was like a business sort of rushed sprint undergrad or something. And so I could work in the business world and function. You know, design thinking is more of a empathetic human-centered design. Those are things I really value today. But Six Sigma, what I would call it's in the acronym DMAIC, define, measure, and analyze, improve, control. That's sort of the problem solving methodology of Six Sigma. And I like it because it gives you something to work through. So, you know, if we're talking about like one of the things I've done in the last year, so I've been a consultant for 10 years, right? And, you know, one instance was, there was a agency I worked with that helps get children into daycare facilities. And, it's a state agency, it's a federal program. And we learned that part of that program, so as I was coming to get used to it and understand it and learn about their vendors and their services, we came across this realization when I was just trying to learn and get on board. We realized that their algorithm was broken. And what that meant, unfortunately, was that there were children who were extremely high need in society that were supposed to be able to essentially cut in line and immediately get vouchers to go to a daycare facility and be enrolled for the day. It was like they could cut in line and get those services, and they weren't getting them. They weren't getting to cut in line. And so, you know, this is one of those moments where you find yourself with like a problem and it can kind of be emotional and you're like, okay, these kids need help. Like, instead of being wherever they are, they could be taken care of today. And so, you know, one of the things we had to go through was analyzing the data. So are we freaking out about one kid? Are we freaking out about 100 kids? Are we freaking out about 1,000 kids? So that's the measure part. We sort of defined the problem. Now we're measuring it. But then we also had the, hey, are there any other kids? Like, is the whole rest of the algorithm working? So we sort of had this, let's go validate that the rest of it is working as it should while we go understand the problem. Because the other challenge you have is you don't want to go tell a CEO or a boss that you know the size of a problem. I've been here where you're like, oh, it's 10. And then you're like, oh, it's not 10, it's 50. We just found out it's 50. And you're going to have to go back. So my advice to anyone is, as much as you want to please people, don't give them the information until you know, or make sure you're working with a leader that understands the caveat of, for now, the problem as we understand it is that there are 10 people impacted. And then you can come back and say, we understand a new flavor, and then now it's twice as many. And so we then measured the problem. And while in this case, while it wasn't, you know, 100,000 children, one matters. Mm-hmm. It really matters in social services. That's the whole point of good government. And so even if the number was one, we had to resolve. So while we analyzed, we realized if it was one or 10, it didn't matter. We had to resolve it. So we could analyze with one team and then work to resolve with the other. And that doesn't mean we went straight to the long-term solution. That meant we figured out, how do we get these children where they need to be Monday morning? And it was Friday night, right? So we had a couple days to figure this out on the weekend. So we sort of broke it down into a short-term problem. How do we get them where they need to be Monday? Long-term problem, who's working on the solution to the algorithm long-term? And then you improve and control. So then you kind of implement those changes. You remeasure, you revalidate, you make sure that the right people are getting the right services. And you know, in lesser impactful examples, you know, like a more boring one would be when I worked on one project where a company was working on a bunch of work as like a middleman, and they would invoice these huge companies for the work they did. And we realized that they weren't getting reimbursed for a high percentage of those invoices. And so we measured those, we worked on it. There were some billing codes that were wrong. We improved it. It still wasn't perfect. You just keep improving it. No, but there's something called a Pareto diagram, P-A-R-E-T-O. And the concept in a Pareto chart is, if you really categorize the reasons why you're not getting that billing code or the reasons why you're not getting those kids the right voucher, it tends to be that there's like four, maybe five at the most, flavors of what's going wrong. And then the rest are like onesie, twosie things where it's just not the best use of your time to resolve. So if it's a kid in a voucher program, you're going to care about it. If it's invoicing codes, you might decide that your money is actually the money you'd spend solving that problem is greater than the amount you'd reimburse for it. And you just move on and you leave some of the codes alone. And so that's just a business decision you make. So those are a couple examples of walking through like Six Sigma using their DMAIC framework.
Mm-hmm. How do most of your clients discover that they need that help? And so the reason I'm asking this question too is for those who are working inside their businesses, and there's, you know, maybe something is starting to be very irritating, right? Like it's rubbing real hard inside the business. What's kind of that tipping point to say like, okay, this is an issue and we need help, and then pausing for long enough to solve the problem rather than charging ahead?
Okay. My real opinion is their own sense of self-value. They will get to a point when they are so tired, they're so burnt out, they don't think it's worth the hours they're working, and they'll either quit, they'll get a different job, or they will understand their value and they will say, hey, in my budget, I need allocation for someone who's an expert, somebody who's really great with data, really good with technology, who can come and help me solve this problem, or I'm not doing it. And it turns out, I don't think I've ever had someone get to that last option of self-value. I don't think I've ever heard of anyone who asks for that. And the answer is just downright no. Maybe they'll have to, you know, negotiate over the actual dollar amount or the size. But most of the time, it's when people have a really big strategic problem. They have a unique differentiator. Maybe the market in their area is introducing something that they can't keep up with. And they're thinking, we have a big complex problem that is sticky and hairy. We don't know how to solve it. We need help. We know technology is part of it. And they start to understand that there are people who do this full time. Mm-hmm. And when they realize that they don't have to be the one, you can be a marketing person with this huge challenge in front of you about your go-to-market strategy, and you need data and tech help. You don't know how to present the problem. You don't have the right data. You don't have the right systems. It's actually a technology problem. Or you can have a market that's differentiating and you don't know how to keep up. And that's an innovation problem, again, which probably requires technology. So I think, you know, when people, there's like a light bulb, and the second that turns on, you see it and you know that somebody isn't just looking for a quote to go make sure that they get the best offer somewhere else. They actually believe they need help thinking through a problem with a peer mentor, somebody who's been through this before. I mean, people go through a CRM transition or an HRM transition or an ERP 3 times, 7 times, under 10 in most of their careers. We do it all day. We do it every day, every year we go through those. And when people realize that 75 to 80% of IT projects fail, and they realize that they're marketing project is actually an IT project.
Yeah.
They start to really want to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so usually we get questions of curiosity, like we talked about earlier, where it's like, hey, how does that work? And what does it mean to work with you? And there's some fear usually about, you know, is this going to cost me a bajillion dollars? But the reality is, what's the cost of getting it wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Right? I recall the moment in my career where all of what you just explained happened to me.
Okay.
So I was the GM of the Reno Aces, the AAA baseball team here in town. And
okay,
under that role, I oversaw all parts of the business, but had a lot of help in each one of those verticals, most of the time. And then there was a time when I did not have strong leadership in our team store, which merchandise for your professional baseball team is a big deal.
Right.
And I had to take it on and revamp. And it's a lot. Like running a retail business that's in person and online is a big deal. And so is buying. Yeah. And people who are not in the middle of the problem have a tendency to underestimate the amount of work that's required, or tell you like, oh, that's easy. Like, I'm sure you can figure out, like they can fluff your ego to make you want to spend more time on the problem.
Yes.
And I worked on it for a bit and I thought, sure, I can learn this, but there's all these other areas of the business calling my attention. We need to bring in an expert. Just so happened that at that same time, I got an email from an expert who was pitching his business, and he specializes in retail buying and retail math. So he could put together what I needed to buy for that next season and also the retail math behind it. Here's what your best sellers are. This is your sell-through rate. Like, put it all together in a beautiful spreadsheet. We could work together and get it done. That investment far exceeded the how much time it would cost me and pull me away from other areas of the business where we were making money in order to solve. That investment was pennies on the dollar, and also provided such tremendous relief from the stress that it was causing to solve the problem. And I remember going into a leadership team meeting and the rest of the group was like waffling on the idea of hiring this guy. And I mean, it was like close to like slamming your fist down on the table sort of presentation where I'm like, this is so necessary. I cannot even believe we are still talking about this. It's costing us more to argue whether or not to hire this person than it would be to just bring him on board. And they were
fine.
Family, we're not fighting with you anymore. We're going to bring in the expert. So for anybody who's thinking about hiring a consultant or a better way to put it is hiring a problem solver.
Yeah,
hiring an expert in that area that can truly help you get the job done and is worth its weight, in gold. Because as you said, like, what is the cost of doing the wrong thing or not solving that problem?
Yeah.
What could happen?
Well, and there's still like, there's also an art, there's a nature to how do you manage a consultant? Like there's still a little bit of detail of keeping your finger on the pulse of what did we agree that they were going to do? Are they on track or not? So you're still spending some energy, but there's no way, like right now I'm the VP of CX and delivery operations, right? I haven't done 10 years of CX. I've done 10 years of consulting, and I understand our business so well that I tend to care deeply about our clients, which is why it makes sense for me to do that job. It doesn't make sense for me to go learn how to do every single component of CX all day, every day. There are people who've done it. We'll leverage them. I will learn it, certainly, and I'll learn it quickly. But there is no way that the highest and best use of my time is making sure I understand exactly how the client lifetime value algorithm doesn't work for anybody, actually. It makes sense for me to learn how to actually design it the right way for us, knowing what I know about our business and leveraging someone who's developed one for hundreds of entities who've used it well or not. And so that combination, like seeing yourself too as an asset to the company and realizing like there's so many people, and I was one of them, who didn't think that way. And then your burnout and your whole argument is about your effort. I'm working so hard and I'm doing all this. And it's like, nobody asked you actually. Nobody asked you to give up your whole life and work. They don't mind that you did, I bet. But I bet it's rare that somebody has a manager who's like riding them at 9 o'clock at night to keep working. Mm-hmm. Most of us do that because we love building and creating, and we want to love our careers. So it's this beautiful intention. But if you start to look at yourself as an asset, you might realize you need to recharge and you're not actually putting your best foot forward at 9 o'clock for the fifth night in a row. Mm-hmm. And actually the stuff you're doing isn't really valuable to the company right now. You're just doing it because you're interested in it. So then let's call it a hobby, not your job. And I think some of that is just helpful to have some self-talk to say, hey, is this the best way to apply my energy to the world today?
Yeah. A hobby or even a habit yeah. to check your email at 9 at night and start responding when you're not like both feet in at right. that time of the day. Like you didn't set your intentions to like solve a specific problem at 9 PM. You yes. just started like surfing your email and answering questions. And was it really as thought out of a reply as it should have been? You know, if you just wrote like, sounds good, is that really what the person was looking for? Or do they want more feedback from you?
Right.
I love how you put that into context. And what's been your experience with managing personal challenges, burnout? You know, now you mentioned you're a mom of two young kids and you have major leadership responsibilities.
Yeah. I think the first thing that's really important is recognizing none of my day. Now, maybe if you're in healthcare, this happens, but nothing I'm doing is like a life or death decision. And I used to behave shockingly like it was. And that made me a really good, what I call an individual contributor. I cared a lot. I worked really hard. It made me a terrible leader. Because I had no grace for myself, which means I couldn't give any to anybody else. My expectations were above anything I could do. And my expectation for everyone else was at the same bar. So no one, including myself, could meet that bar, which by the way, just makes you a fairly miserable person. So I had a lot of fun. Don't get me wrong. I like my life. I have a good life. But I've had some opportunities to learn how to mature myself and understand that it's people first. People, you know, technology change is not hard. Technology change is hard because people change is hard. And if you actually manage people well, if you actually care about them, actually put them first, actually care about yourself and your family and take care of people, most of the rest of the stuff will work itself out because people will develop trust in each other and then they will trust you. And so I think cultivating trust through relationships is actually critical to being a good leader. And then I just think it's about storytelling. It's about connecting the dots. People are going to be confused if you suddenly wake up on Monday and say, oh, we're rolling out a new program and here's your new annual review. And by the way, what you thought you were going to get this month is totally different. And we'll see how it goes next year. That makes sense why they would be upset. And so understanding how like the organizational change management is a phrase that kind of talks about this, but just being a good storyteller that understands, like I do this with my clients too, what headspace was my client in or my employee in or my CEO in when we last talked? What did we agree on? Where was our alignment? And now a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks have gone by and things have probably changed. Do they know? Like, am I going to walk in a room and ask for a new budget for something? And they're going to be like, hold on, that wasn't even in the plan this year. And so I think helping people understand how to pull that thread through different objectives, different touch points, and make sure people feel connected and understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. I think the rest of it really does kind of take care of itself.
That was very well put and so evolved, right? I think in our 20s.
Do you need a keynote speaker for your next conference, ERG meeting, event, or group? I'm here raising my hand. I help leaders grow their confidence so that they can lead more intentional, goal-directed, fulfilled, and happy lives. We are conditioned from our childhood to stay small. Don't be conceited. Run in the middle of the pack, because if we speak out too much or shine too brightly, we will offend other people. This could not be more wrong. When you are your best, most confident leader, you give others permission to shine too. So, how do we get there? How do we increase our confidence? I love sharing my best practices and proven methods to help leaders grow into who they are meant to be. your most confident, authentic self, ready to take on your next biggest challenge in the office and in your personal life. Get in touch at emilyjansen.com. It's a new year, and I want to welcome a new sponsor to the Leadership is Female podcast, Staffy. That's S-T-A-F-I, and they can be found at getstaffy.com. We are all busy professionals, and we have a lot on our plate, and GetStaffy is here to help. They are a virtual assistant company. They're virtual assistants, legal assistants, receptionists, intake client specialists, sales representatives, and paralegals are thoroughly trained and effectively can manage multiple tasks from answering customer inquiries to booking your family activities and managing your calendar and appointments. Plus, you get to save costs with our easy subscription-based service. That's getstaffy.com or reach out to me at Emily Jansen on Instagram, and I will connect you directly to their people. They are a phenomenal company, and we've got an interview with their CEO on the podcast. If you need help, if your company needs help, if you need a virtual assistant that can help save costs and get more done, GetStaffy is the way to do it. GetStaffy.com and mention Leadership is Female, or let me know, and I will put you in touch. Let's go. I don't know about you, but I love learning more about myself. If there's a quiz out there to help me better understand who I am, I'll take it. If there's a journal prompt, I'm using it. But how about a business that helps female leaders communicate effectively while inspiring confidence and trust in those you want to impact? Sign me up. Breakthrough Brands is unlocking clarity for women leading progress. They build leadership brands for women to discover what inspires them, define what drives them, and unlock how to share their brands with others. Do you want to gain clarity on your personal brand? Shoot me a note at leadershipisfemale@gmail.com or on Instagram, and we will introduce you to the women who will help you unlock your leadership brand. That's breakthroughbrands.com.
We get to climb the ladder because we're these individual contributors. And then you get put into this leadership position and all you know how to do is achieve for yourself, not right. for others. So your shift to people first leadership was paramount. And also, you know, now as someone who's VP of customer experience, like you have to be other focused in order to succeed in that role. If you right. were still worried about only your individual contributions, the way that you managed your customers would be more about the company's bottom line than it would be about their experience working with your company.
Right. Well, and you know, for me, what was hard was we're scaling this consulting firm. So when I started, there were like 38 people. There's over 500 now. It's huge. And so for me, what's difficult is, what would be difficult if I hadn't changed is you kind of learn your way and you learn what works and you become exceptional. It's the 10,000 hours rule. I spent 10,000 hours consulting and becoming a lead on accounts in my 20s. And then I became a manager of that. And for a few years, I kind of got it wrong where what I tried to do was create a bunch of mini Jesses. Like, how do I teach them the way I do it, how I do it? I've got, and that kind of becomes controlling, little mama bear-ish of me. And, you know, but it was the only way I knew how I could do it. And I knew what worked for me. I think recognizing that your employees are different than you, and actually they, this is not cheesy. They have a different skill set. They have a different superpower. Unlocking that and helping them understand how to cultivate that to be effective, where maybe you would approach things differently. I treat it like a hypothesis. Maybe I totally disagree with you and how you want to approach your account. Let's agree on what the hypothesis is. Let's have you test it. Let's play it out and let's circle back. And if you're wrong, then try it my way. And if not, we'll go try it a different way. But instead of treating it like I'm right and I have to figure out how to get you to be right too, because there's ego in that and there's pride in that. And also it's fragile, because what happens if it doesn't work for you? Is it broken? Are we all just wandering around aimlessly wondering what life is about? I mean, let's come out, treat it like a science experiment in sixth grade, and let's have some hypotheses and let's learn together. But I think if we approach it like you have to learn from me, I think there's a whole bunch of pain and suffering that we're both in for.
So when you're not leading at this company and growing, and that's incredible growth, by the way, in 10 years of a consulting firm. Amazing. What are you doing when you're not working?
I do a lot of reading. I may or may not have like an adult paint by number around the corner where I paint. I joke that I'm an introvert with extroverted skill sets. So I have a lot of hobbies that are quiet. I will play a little bit of music, a little piano. I have my dogs cuddled up next to me right now, hanging out with them, or the kids is, or my husband. And then just anything active. I love being outside. I love climbing. I love swimming. I love yoga. I'll do pretty much, if I have the time, which is the hard part, I will do absolutely anything that I can. I'm wildly unsuccessful at picking up pickleball, but enjoying the ride.
I have really favorited that game as well. I'm excited for it to be like pickleball season again. It's because I am the worst tennis player ever. And pickleball just like shrinks it down and makes it a little bit more manageable and fun.
Yeah. So yeah. I just don't understand. Some people can send the ball so fast and I can't, I'm not great at, is it backhand or forehand? I'm not great at this one. And then, I can't move the ball. It ends up looking so wiffle sad, like a 4-year-old hit a wiffle ball, but I just enjoy it. I think it's really fun.
Yeah. The people who've gotten really good, really fast are like real serious, and the ball does crazy things, and that I'm not there yet. So I like playing with people who are, they're into it, but it's still fun.
Oh yeah. It has to be that. Like the other thing I really enjoy about that sport that surprised me is we've had like groups of friends meet up and we'll just swap, like we'll kind of play a game and swap and play a game and swap. So we're playing with different teammates and against different people. And it feels so much more about the social playfulness of being together than it is about winning. And and I presume you are too, I'm pretty competitive. So it's fun to play a sport I'm not great at with a bunch of friends just to have fun. It's a good reminder.
Totally, totally agree. All right, let's get into the final four. What is your best piece of advice for women today so that they can level up in their life and career?
Okay, I will probably take the most time on this question. So my warning is I only give women slightly different advice than men because I do believe that, you know, anyone who is interested in developing themselves is going to win. And I want to bet on them, but I do have some key pieces of advice. So one, networking. I used to have a lot of anxiety about networking. I'd go to conferences and I was always nervous and didn't know what to do and hated it. And two, I'm a lightweight. So if you're a lightweight at a conference with an open bar, it's a problem. Here's my secret. And I mean it. I'm serious. I still do this. If you meet me at a conference, I will do this. I will get one drink of a neat bourbon and everyone will leave you alone the whole night. No one's going to ask you if you need a second drink. You're not going to throw back your, I don't know, name a super girly drink and people want to get you a second one. And suddenly you don't know what you've said all night and you're waking up and not sure what you said to whom. Like level-headed is even if you don't drink, just get a bourbon so everyone leaves you alone. And so, that's my one thing. And then the other one is a friend of mine and I call this posting up. So I don't want to have to walk, again, I'm an introvert. I don't have to go start a conversation. If you're at a big networking event, just sit down with your drink and be open if someone comes up to you. You don't have to go start a conversation. You can just post up. Just post up, sit down, chill, and let someone come to you and see what happens. My dog is wanting to get a little closer to me. And then my second piece on helping women level up. I have had some women in my life who have struggled with sort of how to handle if they do feel like they're being treated differently. I have also had younger men struggle with that because they're just being treated differently because they're young. I think there's a lot of different people who've been in this situation. The advice I tend to give probably aligns more with like a Gen X, but an advocate Gen X. And so my advice is not to suddenly, you know, in a group question why they're not looking at you, talking to you, addressing your opinions. One of the things I've suggested is you look back at that thing we talked about earlier about trust and relationship, and you recognize, one, how are you showing up in the room? Younger people tend to have more energy. Sometimes that means they take up a little bit more of the air in the room. So is there room for you to kind of align your energy to the rest of the room and make sure you're contributing an equal amount so that other people have an equal amount of room to show up. The second thing is when you have a moment on the way out the door, if you're in a group situation and you can't really handle it one-on-one, is to ask them for feedback, to say, hey, would you give me any feedback about what I could start, stop, or keep doing? Give me some feedback about what I could do to be a better employee, a better teammate, a better consultant. Insert your relationship dynamic there and show them then that you want feedback and you want a great relationship. And then the third thing is just keep doing excellent work. Don't break your back trying to please that person. You are going to work with people that don't like you. That's hard to hear. But if you really think about it, do you like everyone else? No, you don't like everyone else. There are people you don't like. So just realize that you might be somebody's person they don't like, and that's okay. But you still have a job to do, and you can make it super easy to do a great job. But over time, I've noticed when I've given people this feedback, it has helped develop trust and rapport and respect. I think so far every time. And they've built a relationship with someone that they thought originally didn't like them. And they took it all on as, you know, this person doesn't like me or doesn't like the type of person or gender or age I am. And actually, it might have been more about we didn't have the right dynamic. And when we built it, then maybe it was about that, but we've overcome it together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love all those pieces of advice. And as you're sharing those with the individual, that's also creating something like, oh, this person's yeah. willing to invest their time, knowledge, feedback, opportunities with me if they're lending me these pieces of advice. So, you know, that can plant a tremendous seed.
Yeah.
Especially if we're talking about people younger in their career or even women when, you know, the next time it happens, like you're thinking back to these conversations and, you know,
yeah.
it's beautiful, beautiful advice.
And if you're, I forgot about this. I was going to say this too. If you're ever in a situation where you think that there is something going on that's inappropriate or crossing a line of any kind, I always got the advice from the Center for Creative Leadership to flip it and test it. So to think like, if somebody was, I don't know, theoretically that, you know, you go into somebody's office to talk and they're superior to you and they shut the door and eventually they ask you to like give them a hug or something, flip it and test it. Like think if this was somebody of a different gender or a different race, would it be okay? And if it wouldn't be okay, then there's something to talk about. And also I would advise that we don't do that, just the two of us, that you are getting a third party involved at that point. But otherwise, a lot of this is just like we talked about the world travel. Sometimes there are a lot of people who have not experienced a phenomenal woman in technology. And that means that you get to be the first positive experience they have as a woman in tech or a woman in data. And, you know, that comes, you know, it's sad that that's their first time, but it's also exciting. And it can be an honor.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And that's another way to flip the script, right? You're turning that the first into a positive. And isn't it great? Any opportunity you have to be the first at anything is such an opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of travel, where are you traveling to next?
We go to Costa Rica in like a handful of weeks with our small children. So wish me luck.
You're still traveling big, even with the small kids. I love it. I love it.
We're doing our best.
What is your pump up song?
Okay. So this is going to tell you, it will immediately age me. But I was an emo kid ish. Anything Taking Back Sunday is going to be a pump up song. Of course, anything Taylor Swift, but my real adrenaline rushed running music was, You Know How I Do by Taking Back Sunday or anything else that they wrote.
Love it. And then finally, what is your favorite quote?
I struggle with this question. I don't know that I have a favorite quote. I think that quotes greet me when I need them, if that sounds like the most hippie thing I've ever said in my life. And so when I think about my favorite quote, I think about, okay, so I can be really cheesy. My favorite stanza in a poem is, it talks about living life, and it's, can I say it to you? Can I repeat it?
Yeah.
It's called Thanatopsis. It's the very last stanza, and it says, "So live that when thy summons comes to find, the innumerable caravan that moves to that mysterious realm where all may take his chamber in the silent halls of death. Thou go not like a query slave in the night, but sustained and soothed, approach thy grave like one who wraps the drapery of their couch about them and lies down to pleasant dreams. And I just think it is such a beautiful poem about how to live life.
Oh, that is amazing. This has been such a fun, insightful, wise conversation, Jess. I love this journey we went on.
Me too.
I know that our listeners are going to get so much from it. So where can we continue to be inspired by you and follow along your journey?
Well, we can learn together from each other on LinkedIn. So I think it's Jess Carter on LinkedIn, but you can find me there. And I'm sure you'll have maybe tag me in your show notes or something so people can find me.
Yeah, absolutely. Reach out to Jess. Okay. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast. This was amazing.
Yeah. Thanks, Emily. Appreciate you having me.
Thank you so much for spending your time with us today. Time is your most precious resource, and it means the world that you spent it with us. Please help us reach more people who need to hear these interviews by hitting the subscribe button and the 5-star rating on your iPhone. Do you know someone who could benefit from this interview? Please share it. Take a screenshot and post to your Instagram stories, copy the link and share on LinkedIn, or text that link to your colleague. The Leadership is Female podcast exists to showcase female leadership in sports and entertainment and give you the tips to level up. We will extend a hand back to lead you forward. Extend the same hand by sharing this with someone who needs to hear it. One last thing. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Leadership is Female. Now, take this lesson and run. Let's go.